We continue in our study on Lex Rex, looking at question 38. And here what Rutherford is doing, he's discussing what is the best form of government. And I didn't spend much time in this section because in essence, he says that there are positives and negatives in any form you come up with. There's weaknesses and strengths. And so you could argue in a number of different ways as to what you would prefer. However, he does get very dogmatic about an absolute and unlimited monarchy. He has no time for that. He says this is not only not the best form of government, but it is the worst form. And he says it is so because it is an unlawful ordinance and God never ordained it. So Rutherford says, absolute government is sinful and not a power from God, for God never gave a power to sin. So he says this one doesn't even get onto the playing field. And so this idea in Rutherford remains an important argument in his position, namely that God has not given any authority to the power, to the authority. He has not given them the authority to sin, and to still claim to possess the backing of God. And sin is any want of conformity unto or transgression of the law of God. So he continues saying, all kings are inclined to sin and injustice, and so have need to be guided by a law. Thus Rutherford argues that you cannot have good government when the supreme power, that is the final authority, resides in a sinful man or men, who are inclined to injustice as any other man, and in fact who are more inclined to injustice by the conduct of their place, by the condition of their place or office, and yet they are regarded as ones who can do no injustice against their subjects. This is when you've got a sinful man and you give him this authority, and because of his sinfulness you give him all this authority, he's more inclined to sin. To then say he cannot sin is kind of asking for problems. Question 39 is asking whether the king has any prerogative above the law. For Rutherford, certain privileges that are associated with the office of the king are not indicators of them having prerogatives above the law. For example, he points to Caesar, who could coin money in his own name, and he said, hence, the penny given to Christ, because it had Caesar's image and subscription, Matthew 22:20-21, infers by way of argumentation that they are to give tribute to Caesar as his due, so the magazine and armory for the safety of the kingdom is in the king's hand. The king has such privileges because of his common supreme public office, and because he's a minister of God for the good of the kingdom. And amongst these royal privileges, I reckon that power that is given to the king when he is made king to do many things without warrant of the letter of the law. So he's acknowledging here, acting at times which is not strictly in line with the letter of the law, and he's going to explain what he means by that. There are certain privileges that the king has in that sense, without the express consent of his council. So doing things without the express consent of his council, which he cannot always carry the council with him, as the law says. For example, the king shall not raise armies without consent of the parliament. We have a similar law in our country. You can't declare war without consent, the consent of Congress. And so the law in Rutherford's time was the king couldn't raise armies without the consent of parliament. But he says, but what if suddenly this army landed on your shore and there was no time to convene parliament? What is the king to do? Well, he's to raise an army and to defend the people. And so I think it's probably what our Congress had designed something like executive orders for, where there's actions that are emergencies, they are threatening the welfare of the state, and action needs to be taken. They're not meant to be used to undermine the state and promote one's own agenda, but they're to be used in those things. So he's saying there are such privileges when there's to call the people to defend themselves, and such emergencies when the necessity of justice or grace requires an extemporal exposition of the law. then this is to be done. However, these privileges are not rewards given to princes, but because by office he is obliged to govern the commonwealth, therefore these privileges are given to him, and without them he could not so easily govern. So they're given to him in order to fulfill his primary responsibility. Rutherford says there's no absolute power in a king to do above or against law. All the official power that a king has is a royal power to do good for the safety and good of his subjects, and that according to law and reason, and there is no other power that is given to a king as a king. Now, Rutherford's opponent said that the king's violations of the law was actually God's permissive law to the people, and thus it was morally binding upon them. They were to honor the king's law, though it was contrary to God's law. Thus Rutherford said, if this law of the king be a permissive law of God, which the king may, out of his absoluteness, put in execution to oppress the people, then must God have given a law to every king to play the tyrant. So Rutherford asks, how is it possible to annul a divine law of God through a permissive law? He says, the permissive law is expressly contrary to the law limiting all kings. So God's given this law, this moral law, for example, and now he's saying, because the king is acting in a certain way, that's a permissive law as well, flowing from his office, and so therefore you're bound to obey that and not to resist that, because it's a permissive law, it's coming from God. That's what Rutherford's opponents are saying. So Rutherford says, this law of the king, then, can be no ground for the king's absoluteness above law. And there can be no permissive law of God here. For that which asserteth the king's royal dominion over persons and things, that must be the law of God's approving, not his permitting evil. So when a king is exerting his law according to Rutherford, and that has God's backing, it's got to be a law that is approved by God, not him, God, in the sense God permits evil. He allows people to do evil things. So that's a permitting them to act in a certain way. So when the king is acting in a lawless way, he is permitting the king, God is permitting the king to do evil. Okay, he's not tying his hands together. But for God to approve of that law, he's got to, for God to back the law that the king is doing, he has to approve of the law, not just permit the action. That's Rutherford's argument against the permissive law that Rutherford's opponents were using as a reason why they shouldn't resist the king's lawlessness. Because they're saying if God permitted the king to do that, it has God's backing. And so Rutherford's saying, no, that's not so. Rutherford cites 1 Samuel 8, verses 11 through 15, which tells the people how the king they demanded to have would abuse them. Remember, that's the section where they demanded to have a king like the other nations. And Samuel comes and tells them, and says, do you realize what this king is going to do to you? He's going to tyrannize them. And basically, Samuel says, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots, and he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give them to his officers and his courtiers. So Rutherford says that if we grant authority to the lawless acts of kings and regard them as God's permissive laws, then what Samuel describes in these verses is not an abuse of power given to Saul, but rather a lawful use of power given to the king by God, and thus the king's demands are morally binding upon God's before God upon Saul's subjects. However, Rutherford says the text speaketh of no law or lawful power, or of any absoluteness of King Saul, but of the wicked custom and the rapine and the tyranny. He will take your sons and daughters and your fields and your vineyards from you. Saul took not these through any power of dominion by law, but by mere tyranny. So rather it says that while the king has a responsibility to watch over and protect our private property, he doesn't have dominion over our possessions. And by dominion he means the right to use a thing as you please unless you are hindered by force of law, that is God's law. So the Surya understands you have dominion over your property, you have dominion over your money, over your whatever. And by dominion he means the right to use it however you want, obviously not contrary to God's law. And the king is not the lord and owner of the field and the monies of the private subjects. So Radhav says, the power that the king has over my bread is not a power of dominion, so as he may eat my bread as if it were his own bread, and to be lord of my bread as I have sometimes myself, before I abused it. But it is a dominion improperly and abusively so called, and is a mere fiduciary and dispensatory power, because he set over my bread not to eat it, nor over my house to dwell in it, but only with a ministerial power as a public, though honorable servant and watchman, appointed by the community, and as a mean for an end to regulate my bread, houses, monies, and fields for the good of the public. Now the phrase "the good of the public" there concerns me with Rutherford, what he's saying there. And the king is watching over my stuff for the good of the public. Now if he means for the good of the public in the sense of if he protects my private property, it's good for everybody, that's fine. But I don't think he quite means that. I think he goes a little bit further, because later on he says, so I have dominion over my own garments, home, money, to use them for uses not forbidden by the law of God and man, but I may not lay my cornfield waste, that it shall neither bear grass nor corn. The king may hinder that, because it is a hurt to the public. But the king as lord and sovereign hath no such dominion over Naboth's vineyard. Okay, so he can't steal Naboth's vineyard, but he can stop me from making my acres a wasteland. I think we can discuss that. Maybe you think it's a good thing that the king should intervene to prevent you from turning your maize field into just a dust bowl. I'm opening it up.
Now,
looking at that authority, doesn't that just begin a slippery slope of having dominion over everything?
For sure. To me, I don't know where you draw the line, because what are you doing that is not within the best interests of the public?
Yeah.
And who interprets that? So to my mind, if you want to turn your cornfield into a dust bowl, that's better for me as the next door farmer, because I'm going to make more money on corn next year. Mm-hmm. So I think he's...
Here's an example where what he's advocating gets really interesting, because when you've got things like the NDAA, the National Defense and Authorization Act, passed by Congress, signed by the President, and reauthorized year after year after year, there are things in there that would take all those liberties away and completely strip them. So it seems a little sort of like what he was saying. There's a line, and the line starts getting closer and closer to absolute, complete, total tyranny. At what point does the individual say, okay, that's far enough? I mean, you mentioned executive order stuff, right? They're only supposed to be used under duress, right, for the government. But that's no longer, that hasn't been the case for 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
It's kind of weird. I'm trying to figure out how to think properly about
it. Right. Because when you've got a president who disregards the law,
right,
exercising the law, the law of the executive order, for what?
And every issue that he brings, he thinks is like immediately necessary right now. And forget Congress, I'll just sign it and pass it.
But I hate law.
Right.
But you better uphold this law. Mm-hmm. So question 40 asks whether the people have any power over the king by his oaths or his covenant that he makes. He swears to uphold whatever. That's an oath he takes, enters into covenant with the subjects. Rather, it says, now, every office requireth essentially a duty to be performed by him that is in office. And where there is a duty required, there is some obligation. If it be a public duty, it is a political obligation. And he says that the political duty is between equals, like, for example, two neighboring nations. There's duties even between two nations, Rutherford says. Although they are equal and independent from one another, they still have binding duties to each other. This is because they exist in God's universe, and his universe functions according to his ordained ordering. And thus, there exists covenantal obligation upon all people and nations, even if they deny the existence of God. There's still, every unbeliever has to relate to me in terms of God's covenantal obligations. He can't treat me however he wants. And so that's basically what he's pointing out here. Thus, when the Ammonites humiliated David's messengers, David and Israel could compel them to political duties of political association or relationship. And David and Israel, as by the law of nature, they may repel violence with violence. So if the laws of nations be broken, as you remember, the laws of nations are God's universal laws as to how you treat and relate to one another. It was an assumed way, even when the founding fathers spoke about the laws of nations, as something that was universally recognized and binding. And so when the laws of nations be broken, the one may punish the other, though there is no relation of superiority or inferiority between them. Likewise, whenever there is a covenant, an oath betwixt equals, yea, or superiors and inferiors, the one has some coactive power over the other. So he gives another illustration. You've got this, even if you've got inferiors and superiors, once there is a, like for example, if the father give his bond, and I'm assuming this is some kind of legal signed document, the father give his bond to pay his son £10,000 as his patrimony to him, though before the giving of the bond, the father was not obliged, but only by the law of nature, to give a patrimony to his son. Yet now, by a political obligation of promise or covenant and a right, a document, he is obliged to his son to pay £10,000, that by the law of nations and the civil law, the son now, as a coactive power, by law can compel his father, though his father is his superior, to pay him no less than £10,000 of patrimony. Though therefore the king should stand simply superior to his kingdom and estates, which Rutherford doesn't agree with that, but even if he is standing superior to his kingdom and estates, yet if the king come under covenant with his kingdom, as Rutherford says he has proved at length, the king must, by that same, come under coactive power to fulfill his covenant. For, saith the law, what any doth promise falleth under debt. So as soon as you promise something, you're under debt to pay it. And because the king has gone into covenant and he has sworn obedience, he has sworn an oath to do certain things, he's now in debt to do those things. If the covenant be public and civil, then the king must come under a civil obligation to perform the covenant. And though there be none superior to king and people on earth to compel them both to perform what they have performed, yet by the law of nations each may compel the other to mutual performance. We both have covenantal obligations to fulfill here. And so Rutherford says, this is evident by the law of nations. If one nation break covenant with another, though both be independent, yet hath the wrong nation a coactive power to force the other to keep covenant, and then to punish them, because nature teaches to repel violence by violence. So it be done without desire of revenge and malice. And this is evident by the nature of a covenant, which is also seen in the fact that the creditor has coactive power, though he be an equal or inferior to the man who is surety, who lent him the money, I mean who he lent money to, even by law, to force him to pay. And the judge is obliged to give his coactive power to the creditor, that he may force the surety to pay. Hence it is clear that a covenant maketh a free man under the coactive power of law to an equal or even a weaker to fulfill his covenant. He has to do that if he is sworn. So, but he's just bringing in different examples to try and prove the fact that once the king has entered into covenant and oath with the people, he is bound to fulfill those things. Although he points out there's covenants on both sides. The people have made a covenant as well to do certain things. Rutherford says, no man, even by man's law, can annul a confirmed covenant. And therefore the man that made the covenant bringeth himself under law to fulfill his own covenant. And so must the king put himself under men's laws by a covenant at his coronation. And so finally tonight, what are kings but vassals to the state, who if they turn tyrants, fall from their right? So that is bringing us close to the end of what Rutherford has to say on on these things, stuff that is relevant. I have left out sections that I feel are arguing points that are a bit dated for us. But are there any questions or comments on what we cover tonight?